there's no denying the significance of that music off of Pink Floyd's album The Wall. This is Pat Prince, editor of Goldmine Magazine, and this is the Goldmine Podcast. But what about the artwork behind the music? I mean, anyone who has that album or has seen the 1982 movie The Wall or been to the concerts is familiar with that artwork. Artwork done by the artist Gerald Scarf. Goldmine has spoken to Gerald before about his art, but now the San Francisco Art Exchange is offering his entire collection. What remains of the masterworks created by created for The Wall, album sleeve, live concert performance, and film. Gerald, of course, worked closely with bassist, lyricist Roger Waters on these other components of The Wall, and now they will be up for grabs in one single collection. And over the years, this is basically a treasure trove that has been collected over the years. All this Wall-related art collected by Gerald in his office. In fact, you can see a photo of his office on Goldmine's online page that goes with this podcast episode. But he has worked with the San Francisco Art Exchange before, about 3 years ago. He did auction off some art, successfully, that is. One of the pieces, the iconic painting titled The Scream, that iconic image from the film for, I think it sold for, nearly $2 million. And this time he's selling the rest of the collection, the archive as he calls it, but via online at San Francisco Art Exchange's website, www.sfae.com. Sfae.com. Who knows, maybe a museum, a corporation buys it, or a wealthy collector. But Gerald emphasizes that he would love it to be one as a collection that goes, keep it all together. But we'll see. We'll have Gerald on this episode to describe what the remaining archive is made of. And we'll be right back after this message.
Hey, I'm Ronald Webb, and this is Patrick Prince.
And together we host the Goldmine Radio Hour, the show that features the latest issue of Goldmine,
the music collector's magazine. Tune in Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on CygnusRadio.com.
Hello?
Gerald?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Pat Prince from Goldmine Magazine.
Hi, Pat.
How are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
Last time I spoke to you, it was in 2017.
Oh.
And that was when the San Francisco Art Exchange, I think it was the first time they put your artwork up for sale. Is that correct?
Well, I think it was 2017. Yeah, I think it was 2017. Yeah.
And that went well, relatively well, right?
They not only relatively well, extremely well. I mean, I was, Jim and I were very happy about that. And, it went just like clockwork. And, the guy just who bought it just had to have it. And, it's a part of his life and his background and everything. And so that was a done deal almost immediately.
So it was a private collector for The Scream, right? The iconic painting?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. 1.8 million, which
sure,
is...
Sure, sure. Yeah. And he saw it on a screen in Times Square in New York, and he said, don't sell it to anybody else. I want it. And so he was very definite about it.
Was he a Pink Floyd fan, or was he just a fan of the art?
He was a Pink Floyd fan and a fan of the art. I mean, both
right.
In this case going together. But I think that, the music and the lyrics of Roger and the others had a big effect on him. I mean, I've met a lot of people or spoken to a lot of people or had emails from many, many people who say the same thing, that, that... I guess music is very evocative and can bring back, your childhood or when you first met your girlfriend or your boyfriend or got married or all of these things. These moments in your life sometimes get matched or marked, might as well get marked by you know, a particular piece of music that was playing at the time or whatever. I guess that was the case with him. I mean, there was a very nice guy, American, asked me if he could. You may know the story. I don't know, but anyway, I'll tell it. He asked if he could have my signature so that he could have it tattooed onto his arm.
Oh, yeah.
You know all that, yeah. you know, he said that the music and my pictures got him through the Gulf War.
Yes.
That's hard to imagine, but, you know, he meant it because he sent me his Gulf War medal, you know.
Right.
And I sent it back and saying, you're the hero and I'm the artist. But it just shows you how strong music, lyrics, pictures, or whatever, and put them all together, you know, how big an effect they can have.
Yeah, it sounds like that Ray Bradbury short story, The Illustrated Man. The guy had tattoos of all your art on his body.
Yes.
Now, I'm sure, have you heard from him again? Or maybe he's gotten more artwork.
Yeah, no, he's around. He has, you know, he in fact, he can, I have a bar in London called Scarf's Bar, which is in a certain hotel. And he came there to say hello to me in person and to kind of thank me. And he brought with him a friend of his that I was very interested to meet. And that friend was, I can't remember his second name, but you probably will know it. His name was Frank, and he was in the Leonardo DiCaprio film. He was the character in the Leonardo DiCaprio, Catch Me If You Can, which was about a confidence trickster. Do you know that
film?
Yes,
yes.
And his name is Frank something.
Yeah.
As slips my mind. But anyway, he now works in security, of course, because being a confidence trickster himself,
yes,
he knew where, you know, the weaknesses in the system were. So he began to work for the FBI rather than they let him off. You remember the film. This guy came with Frank because this Frank works for this guy in a similar sort of way. Watching for glitches in his system. I have met him, but this bar of mine is extraordinary because it's got to be named after me, and it's named after the idea of it is a bar. The group is called Rosewood, and you have them all over America, I think. But the Hotel Carlyle in New York has a similar bar, which is called Bemelman's Bar. Well, I'd never heard of Bemelman, but the Rosewood in London came to me and said, you know, we want to do Bemelman's Bar in London. And Bemelman apparently was a New Yorker artist of the 1920s, that kind of era, 1930s, who used to go into the bar and sketch on the walls, so the story goes, to pay for his drinks. And that has become, apparently, Bemelman's Bar is well-known to New Yorkers as a place to go on the way after work, you know, and relax and have a drink. So they matched it up with Scarf's Bar here, and I have all over the bar are these paintings that I've done of various characters, you know, of presidents and prime ministers and so forth. So it's fun.
Did you illustrate on the wall for them?
No, because it was a heritage building. And, so I made oil paintings, and they have affixed them to the wall.
Gotcha.
So it really looks like they're on the wall, but it's actually underneath. It's beautiful marble, so they didn't want to destroy that.
Now, the storyboard, if you go to the San Francisco Art Exchange website, it's filled with wall memorabilia from you, but I'm looking at the room you're sitting in this photograph.
Yeah.
It looks like a man's cave.
Sure is a man's cave, yeah.
And well, I believe that's the storyboard there. So that you were kind of on the fence about selling this, right? But it didn't sell.
I was, yeah. And I was on the fence about selling quite a lot of it because it's been around and it is, you know, as it in its entirety, you know, is a history of how this what now appears to be an iconic piece of music and film. My collection of this and that and the other is a complete history of how that thing was put together. So I really wanted to keep it together, you know. But then, of course, you know, along comes somebody who wants to pay that sum you mentioned for the yes. Scream, and what am I going to do? Say no. And so, yes, the room I'm sitting in there is the room that Roger and I actually put the wall together. That is the wall, the film.
Right.
Before that, we worked in other places and so on. But this is in my house in Chelsea. And it's a huge room. And, you know, I would pin little bits of drawing on the wall. And we would discuss that and then move them around. And eventually a storyboard kind of emerged. And so I was continually making little drawings, putting them together. There are some, you know, storyboards like the one I think that's for sale, which is a complete kind of suggestion, all on one piece of paper. It's like 6 feet long, a piece of paper.
And yes.
2 feet wide or something like that.
Yeah, but, I see it right here.
It's, yeah, and that is, all, you know, a suggestion of pictures that we might employ for the show and the film, or the film, I think it was just the film. So there are other storyboards too, which of course are just individual pieces which we pinned on the wall and moved around to position them correctly for the narrative. And so the photo. If you're thinking of the photograph, I'm thinking of it. I'm surrounded by stuff.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
And you could charge admission for this room, access to get into it.
Well, I'm afraid that room no longer exists. You know?
Oh, okay.
I've sold that house now and moved on to a smaller place because our kids have grown up and the usual story, you know. And so the wall room it's interesting because, I mean, I have heard of cases where artists' rooms have been moved entirely to museums.
Yes.
Obviously, they're not going to do that. But recreated in other... Francis Bacon, the famous painter, his room was moved entirely to Dublin from where he originated. And you can go there and see his room.
There seems to be a lot of Francis Bacon influence in your style,
He was a great hero of mine, I do have a catalogue. I went to a show of his in the Marlborough Gallery in London in the 60s, I think it must have been, he signed my catalogue for Gerald Scarfe, Francis Bacon, you know, I've got that, of course. But he was a great influence in a way because he... saw us all, I guess, as lumps of meat, which we're moving, thinking lumps of meat. But somehow he worked backwards from that and showed these screaming, tortured beings.
Yes.
And it kind of fitted in with the way I felt about things.
Well, is this for a limited time again, your stuff being on sale with the San Francisco Art Exchange?
Well, it'll be limited, I guess, by the fact that me wanting to sell it as a unit,
yes,
as one piece. Ideally, I would like it to go into a museum because that, you know, certain parts of it are at the moment actually touring here in Britain. I have a show traveling around called Scarf on Stage and Screen, and it's not only the wall, but it's other work I've done for Walt Disney. I was production designer on Hercules,
yes,
and I designed the Magic Flute with Peter Hall, which recently played about a month ago in Dallas. That's still going around. That played in Dallas. So this show is traveling around, and that is all, you know, variations of my work, not only for rock and roll, but for opera. And for Disney and for theater.
One thing I was going to ask about your career is, were you ever a political cartoonist at all?
Oh, well, I was 50 years a kid political cartoonist for the Sunday Times here.
Yes, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that is my main... If you ask a British person, who is Gerald Scarfe, they say, oh, he's a political cartoonist. And, of course, I'm known for The Wall and Disney and all the other things as well, but...
See,
the majority of the people would know me because I worked for 50 years in the Sunday Times.
See, I mean, rock and roll biased. I'm thinking in rock and roll terms.
Well,
you would
know what exactly, and I mean, and of course, the people who think politically, they're politically biased, so they don't all of them know about the rock and roll bit.
Right.
Believe
me. You still do that because in this time,
I gave it up about a year or so ago, a couple of years. It's, you know, I've got so much else to do and so many other things I enjoy doing. I've just produced two books, you know, that, so all of that takes time and energy and I like doing it. So, but I kind of got tired of drawing these stupid, bloody politicians, you know, week after week. I mean, Mr. Trump is my muse, really, you know, he does... something interesting, and I say interesting, strangely interesting, every day, really. So he's very good material for my work. And over here we have Boris Johnson, he's another kind of walking caricature.
You could have all the characters, I know, the ones who oppose them, too. There's a lot of anger going around. And... I love how you take your style, you take a person or a character, and you make them look like their inner personality, whether it be ugly or beautiful or striking.
Sure.
I could see exactly doing that for all the politicians very easily. So, I have to do some research on your stuff for the papers.
Well, you go to my website, you should see a lot of political work there, but then also these books are around, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting you have to buy a book, but I've produced many books over the years, and the majority of them are political.
Yeah. See, you turned me on to something. So now, this is why you fit in perfectly as a team with Roger Waters, because of course, he's always somewhat political, isn't he?
Well, he had. Yeah, I mean, not people wouldn't have originally thought that. I think when I first met him in the 70s, but.
No.
He has become increasingly political,
yes,
and is using the wall as a political tool.
Yes,
now I mean, when I look back, I think maybe is that why Roger first came to me, because I was renowned as a political cartoonist. Maybe he wanted more of a political film even in those days, and I played it more towards the surreal rather than the political. You know.
Yes.
Although, of course, there are political thoughts in there about education and misuse of power and all the usual, you know, things. So, you know, that we work well as a team. That's all I know. And we got on well, and we laughed at things together, and it sort of worked. And I didn't tread on his toes as a musician, and he didn't tread on my toes as an artist. We worked as a team.
Obviously, you make a wonderful team, and the thing that you both do well is you both don't like the abuse of power, and you visualize that quite well. And
no, exactly, no.
I'm wondering if I would love to see the two of you come back and do something again. I don't know if that will ever happen, but...
Well, we did talk about it, but, you know, this is such a success, it's hard to kind of repeat a success, and... we worked on a thing called Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking, which was Roger's, another of his albums, which was fine, but didn't have the same kind of thing for me.
Right. I mean, he pitched The Wall and that to his bandmates, and they picked The Wall.
Yeah.
And that ended up being a solo album. But, he's got plenty in him, and he's
it's difficult to get hold of Roger these days.
He's trying to make up for so much time, I guess. I don't know, but it seems like he's definitely on the road a lot.
He enjoys it.
But going back to the you said you would really be interested in selling the remaining artwork as a whole.
Yeah.
Couldn't you see it all in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum in Cleveland? I mean...
Yeah, I can, but, you know, you need someone who has that kind of a... They care that much about Pink Floyd and they and the wall, and then they, which a lot of people do, but then a lot of people don't have millions and millions of dollars to spend. I'm sure they'd love to.
Right.
So, it, you know, ultimately we'll do it, but it's not a big field to play, I guess.
Well, I'm looking at all these different things that you were selling. I could see there are things that for the average collector could be somewhat affordable.
Well, that's what we're going to do, I think, next. You know, if this doesn't work, we will ultimately be selling piece by piece. And Jim already has a lot of interest in that. It's just me saying, listen, this is a piece of history.
Right.
Please, somebody, keep it as a piece of history.
Right.
Because once it's split, you know, it's all over the place. And, and ever to put that exhibition together again would be very difficult because it would be all over the world, really. I mean, people would be buying bits here and there.
That's a good point. It's better to have it all together. But I would love, personally, myself, for something affordable like, you know, the flags or the...
Yeah, yeah.
The stage props, the film and stage props, the
sure.
stuffed pink doll, the crossed hammers banner.
Sure.
The crossed hammers has to be one of the most arresting animation series of images, I think. The goose-stepping hammers is just... It sends a chill down my spine,
that's what it was meant to do. But it's sort of forces of fascism, please. It really, the forces of fascism. And when Roger and I first talked about it, I thought, what is the most unrelenting, thoughtless, mindless implement I can think of? And it was a hammer, really. And the cruelty of a hammer, you know, the brute force of the iron head of a hammer. And so that, I decided, would be the symbol of oppression and of fascism. And then when, you know, sometimes it worked the other way around. When I designed that, then Roger wrote hammer, hammer, hammer into the lyrics. So
right.
It sometimes goes both ways, you know.
Well, the thing about it is I think that there needs to be that that an art, because so easily people forget that, or they think that will never happen here. You know, that sort of fascism will never happen again.
Mm.
But that is the problem, that it can
be... Well, it's happening all over the world all the time, isn't it?
Exactly. And so people need to be aware of that. And politically active. And I think your art, and here it worked well with Roger's lyrics. It was magic, quite frankly. But
sure.
I hope that it does sell all at once together, because like you said, the collector can lend it to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something like that. But on another side of it, gives guys like us who have a limited income to buy some stage and film props.
Sure. I mean, there may be, you know, if the exhibition is finally curated and put together as a thing, there will be an overflow. You know, there'll be a lot of doubling up on
there
things.
There you go, and yep.
So there'll be some trimming, I guess, to do to make it into a reasonable exhibition. And then beyond that will be, you know, other bits and pieces
available. You know, you keep in touch. You know, I'm sure your PR will keep in touch. I'd love to see where this goes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
and you know, we'll be in touch, and Goldmine will, of course, you know, keep on promoting it so people will be out there looking at it. A lot of memorabilia people read Goldmine, and of course, they're all rock and roll memorabilia. So,
of course.
And wish you all the best with it, of course.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for the call, and all the best to you and Goldmine.
Thank you so much, Gerald.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye now.
Thanks, Gerald Scarf. Go to San Francisco Art Exchange's website to find out more. That's at www.sfae.com. Okay, everyone. Thanks again for listening. This is Pat Prince, editor of Goldmine, signing off. Don't forget to go to Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, those select stores, and pick up the latest issue of Goldmine on the newsstand. Also, go to goldminemag.com. The website has been redesigned. It looks great. You can get all information there about collecting, music collecting, and also exclusive articles and a percentage off on your subscription price. All right, everyone. See you next time.
Hey everybody, this is Brian Reisman, host of the podcast Side Jams, which is now a proud member of the Pantheon family of podcasts. I've been a freelance entertainment journalist for 25 years now, and I often end up in conversations that go off on tangents. Suddenly you're discussing someone's outside passion or hobby, something you didn't know about, and it leads into revelations about their character and about their life outside of their art. I've often had to cut those details out because a story had a strict word count or a specific focus, so here, the entire focus of the podcast is just on their side jam or side jams. For example, Alice in Chains frontman William Duvall spent some time talking to me about reading history, which led him into talking about his public school education and how it was so terrible in high school that he actually managed to get into a private school for free so his life could take a different course. In this series of podcasts, you're going to be hearing my interviews with musicians of all different backgrounds and genres, talking about everything from surfing to collecting antiques to stargazing. I hope you enjoy Side Jams. Please tune in regularly, and I'll have a lot of interesting guests in store for you.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.